Oral History Program at Foundation for Iranian Studies. Interview with Mr. Ernest Oni. Interviewer Sayed Valireza Nasr, Washington, D.C., May 22nd, 1991. Mr. Oni, thank you very much for accepting our invitation and participating in the Oral History Program of Foundation for Iranian Studies. Let us begin by a brief account of your own background, where you were born, your education. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I was born in Wellington, Ohio, on May 31st, 1920, and educated in the high school there. I graduated from high school in 1938, and went directly to a small college south of Wellington, Ashland College, now Ashland University, where I spent the next 4 years. I did general academic, but I specialized in Greek, in Latin, and in French. I graduated in late May of 1942, just in time to be drafted into the United States Army. I spent the next 42 months with the Army as a mostly as a medical technician, a brief period in the Signal Corps, but I was also chosen in the ASTP program, that's the Army Specialized Training Program, to go to Indiana University and study Turkish. So I spent about 4 or 5 months at Indiana studying Turkish and Turkish history and Balkan politics in general. This, as it turned out, was just before D-Day. So the program was closed up, and since I was a medic, I was put in the stream of replacements to be sent to Europe. I spent 18 months in Europe as a medic with the 26th Infantry Division. Patton's Third Army, had a total of 210 combat days. After the war in Europe ended, I got a chance to go to Paris for 3 months to continue studying French at the University of Paris. And finally, in December of 1945, I came back to the States and was discharged in January. I was married 1 week later, and a week after that I started back again to Ashland College and picked up my second bachelor's degree in Bachelor of Science in Education. The GI Bill was in effect then. That was a government program which gave to anybody that wanted to go back to college, an equivalent of their service time plus, I believe it was 1 year. So I had 4.5 years of qualification for this. And I was accepted in the graduate program at the University of Chicago in the Department of Linguistics. So the next let's see, I graduated, I got my PhD in December of 1950 in linguistics. And my specialty at that point, the subject on which I wrote my dissertation was hieroglyphic Hittite. Obviously, I needed a job, and academic jobs were in short supply right at that point. But Professor Gelb, who was a Hittite specialist at the Oriental Institute, and the man with whom I had done my dissertation and much of my graduate work, was a former military intelligence officer in World War II. And he had a friend in Washington who was working, who had gone to work for CIA. It just happened that at that point, CIA was also looking for people, people who had some kind of an interest in, what was it, Chevron, interest in something besides making money. Since it wasn't out of profession once you made much money. But I had done some work on the Middle East, enough to indicate that I was interested in the area, although it didn't have a great deal of relevance to what was going on currently. As a hieroglyphic Hittite is long, but I had studied Turkish, and in graduate school I had studied Old Persian and Avestan and some Pahlavi. So at least I had demonstrated an interest in the area. So after the usual amount of filling out forms and correspondence back and forth, I went to work for CIA in July of, last part of July 1951. Mm-hmm. So I came down to Washington from Chicago together with my wife in May, July 1951, and after the usual entrance testing and so on, I immediately went to work. I was assigned to the Office of Current Intelligence, and the job of Current Intelligence was just, as the name suggests, to follow current political developments and report on them in an agency publication every day, if there was anything worth reporting. I was assigned to the GTI, the Greece, Turkey, Iran branch of OCI, at which point there were only two people. I was the second one, and there was a woman who had come on board about a few months earlier. The agency, although it had been in existence for a couple of years, was still in a state of development and transition. I immediately began reading the material that came in, the State Department reports, dispatches and telegrams, reports from the CIA station in the area. In the areas, rather, because at this point we were both responsible for all three countries, Greece, Turkey, and Iran. And we wrote, well, you could say copiously, although not extensively. Each one of us at that point was writing maybe three or four kind of news-type articles every day on one or the other of those three countries.
What did your the material you said would come from field officers that you would write on?
Yes, all the material. In theory, we got all of the material that came in through the U.S. government dealing with our country, from the State Department, from CIA sources, from agriculture. If the Foreign Agricultural Service happened to have something, there were agricultural attachés in the embassies that reported through their channels. There were commercial attachés. There was reports from on Point 4 activities.
Everything would be included.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was our job to read all this, pick out what appeared on that day to be that we thought would be of interest to the readers of our publications. And our readers were, generally speaking, seen as policymakers, people who made policy but who did not have the specialized knowledge in any particular area. Obviously, a great deal of it was political reporting, although we did, on occasion, do some economic reporting, particularly during the period of the 51 to 53, when there was the dispute between the Iranian government and the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, over the nationalization of oil. That was probably, during that period, was probably the main topic that we followed. There was another...
Was the thinking on this issue uniform from the beginning? Before it became, since you followed it from 15?
Well, I don't think it was uniform from the beginning. It took some time before we were able to sort out the various strands of what was going on, to understand what the British position was, understand what the Iranian position was.
But to what extent, say, did the British have, or the British intelligence, or the British opinion, or ambassador, public relations in the U.S. have an impact on the analysis of this, or was the analysis solely based on what came out of Iran?
The analysis was based primarily on material that was coming out of Iran, plus the news reports that we read, the various studies that were prepared by, or I think that maybe the IBRD did a study. You know, everyone was doing something, analyzing the oil, the oil situation. But from the analytical point of view, there was no, if what you're asking, was there any outside influences?
I don't mean necessarily political, directly in the form of orders, but in the sense that as the material were coming in, the British obviously being a part to the whole dispute had a particular view of it.
Oh yeah, sure. But we also had the Iranian view, since the ambassador there was talking with Mossadegh and his advisors all the time. Mm-hmm. And of course there was a Harriman mission that that went over to try to bring the two sides together to an understanding. I think the whole thrust of the American effort at that point was to try to get the two sides to agree on a position that would solve the dispute, and to give each one a little bit, but neither one everything. There was considerable sympathy for Mossadegh and Mossadegh's position, but I think he was
within the agency.
Yeah, within the agency, I think, certainly in the State Department. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, he was his own worst enemy, because he never, as the ambassador reported at one time, in considerable frustration, he said, "I have seen Mossadegh," I'm paraphrasing because obviously I don't remember the precise wording after all this time, but he said something to the effect that I saw Mossadegh again today and found out that he had not only retreated from the position that he held yesterday, but was back to the position that he had held day before yesterday. I think that was a fairly good explanation of the problems in dealing with Mossadegh, and he could not or did not develop. Let me back up. He couldn't see any kind of compromise, and of course this was what. What the ambassador and the United States General was trying to find a compromise between the two sides.
So before we progress any further, before this era began, say when Razmara was Prime Minister,
yeah.
Did at that time the U.S. or the agency, the CIA, have specific opinions in the way that you might see they might have about the world leader today? As to maybe he's a strong man, we should back him up, something should be done, or was the involvement not yet as detailed?
I don't think that, you mean with Rushmore?
For instance, with Rushmore is a good case in point since he was a paramount figure in a way.
Yeah, he was. I've seen since allegations, excuse me, allegations of perhaps a closer relationship with Rushmore than I thought really existed. I know, trying to recollect some of the reporting that came in, there was reporting on Rasmussen's speculation that Rasmussen had dreams of being a strong man, maybe even shoving the Shah aside. I suspect that the Shah may have felt the same way. Rasmussen perhaps had that, you know.
But this awareness existed, kind of, this awareness of his possible ambitions existed at that time with the CIA?
Yeah, and with State Department.
And with State.
Simply because that seemed to be a very common pattern. You get a strong figure like Rasmussen or Mossadegh or sometimes Kavan. They seem to develop to the point of challenging the Shah rather than using the Shah to achieve national goals, if you like. I think, do you understand what I'm suggesting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever the goal was of Rasmussen or Mossadegh, or maybe Kavan, or maybe much later Bakhtiar, whatever the original goals may have been, mm-hmm. It seems to me that ultimately it boiled down to a challenge to the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Iranian politicians missed a number of good opportunities to advance the interests of Iran, of reform, and so on, by aiming at the Shah instead of if you like, co-opting him. In the early days, I think it would have been possible, say, after maybe even as late as 1960.
By aiming at him, you mean?
Aiming to supplant or supersede or shove him into a purely ceremonial position. In the early days, the Shah was quite an uncertain figure. He, I think in his own mind, he had his father maybe as a figure that he admired and would like to emulate, but personally, he was not he was uncertain of what he could do, how to do it. During this period, I think Iranian politicians in general, if they played their cards right, could have made a genuine contribution. Instead of sniping and trying to undercut the Shah, they could have, if you like, shoved him aside.
Mm-hmm.
But they, again, like Mossadegh, too many Iranian politicians were their own worst enemies. They spent a lot of time fighting each other. This was one reason why I think that the embassy slowly, and I say slowly, came to the viewpoint that the Shah was about the only stable figure with whom they could deal.
Well,
because governments and prime ministers came and went so fast,
mm-hmm.
that there was no one to talk to constructively.
Mm.
Well,
there was no sense of maybe, as usually was done elsewhere in the Third World, that the military is the better stable.
The military. No, I don't have the feeling that that the military, or any member of the military, was ever looked on as the solution to everyone's problems.
Not even Razmara or Zahedi.
Well, not even Razmara. Not Zahedi.
How come? Because lesser generals in other third world countries were looked upon favorably to bring stability or perform that function. Why not in the case of Iran at that time? If you look with Heinz in the framework of that period of thinking, why not in Iran? We're discussing this issue of why wasn't a military option you think looked upon at that time?
It's a good question. I don't know whether I can find a good answer or not. Perhaps for a couple of reasons. Now, if I had a chance to reread all the material again from, say, the 1950s, and refresh my memory, I might come up with a little different side. But it seems to me in most of the third world countries where the military came to dominate, that they achieved, a military leader or a coup leader achieved his position of dominance in his country and then was recognized by the United States. Iran, of course, had a long history of vigorous politics, if often destructive. And there was a political system. There was a sophisticated and generally educated group of politicians. I think the whole political scene in Iran was considered as something viable without the military participation directly. I would not be surprised, for example, if somebody digging in the archives would dig up a piece of paper speaking where somebody in the embassy reported admiringly on Razmara and his potential for being a strong man, and pick up the piece of paper and say, "Ha-ha, see, and that shows that the United States was looking for military dictatorship." What that would really show was that people in the embassy were looking at Razmara, looking at all the other politicians, for their potential to see where they stood on the various problems, and not that the embassy was supporting Razmara or later supporting Bakhtiar or even Zahedi, except in a limited sense. Zahedi was not supported so much as a military man, I think, as kind of reluctantly as somebody who was available.
I detect in your rendition of these generals that you look upon Zahedi with a reluctance yourself. Why was that, you think? Why was he sort of reluctantly accepted?
Well, of course, Zahedi, and I don't know how he was picked out, or who made the choice. The British were not happy initially with the idea of having Zahedi move in as prime minister.
Even though he acted as a prime mover in that operation that toppled the government?
Before the operation, when the agency or somebody in the agency, now, understand, I was not in operations at that time. Mm-hmm. So this was...
You're working in analysis.
I was working in analysis. As a matter of fact, at the time of the operation 1953, Ajax, the analytical side was not aware of what was going on. And analytically, we had reported, because we did in our analysis, reported rumors of a coup attempt against Mossadegh. But there had been rumors of a coup against Mossadegh for most of his career. You know, from 51, 52, and into 53, we were always picking up rumors of this group plotting against Mossadegh, or this group plotting against Mossadegh. So when we heard a few reports of a group around Zahedi, analytically, we dismissed it as having much of a chance of success, because Mossadegh had not only become aware of what was going on previously, he had moved very, very shrewdly to block those attempts. So, analytically, our position was that Zahedi presented no threat, and Mossadegh would probably be able to block his move. At that point, it seems that our reporting upset somebody in the State Department who was aware of what was going on. and raised the question, well, if your analysts don't think Zahedi has a chance of
pulling it off,
of doing the job, I should be getting support. Because that was the key thing. If we had known at that point of American-British participation, that would change our whole analysis, because that threw into the equation a very important point.
A very important source of support for the guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we reported with initially without any knowledge of that. But that forced the people in operations to come and say, hey, you didn't know this. Of course we didn't know it. But that, putting that into the balance, made a significant difference in our approach. At this point, it might be well to point out something you may already know, and that's there was long, and maybe to this day, a deep division, almost a compartmentation between operations and the analytical side. And in those earliest days, we barely knew, the analysts barely knew who was working in operations. The idea was, I suppose, based on security, analysts were generally overt employees of the agency, identified themselves as employees of the agency. And the operations side did not. They operated, you know, they were some other State Department or military or whatever. So this division, which persisted for many years, and as I say, may still persist, was always something of a barrier toward complete understanding what was going on. I should say that after I managed to move into operations for a couple of tours, I had a much better idea of the problems that they faced. And conversely, becoming personally acquainted with the people, I was able for the rest of my career to talk freely to them about what was going on. It was very useful. This was not to a great extent the official agency position. Okay, I wandered off a bit, but I wanted to.
It was very useful. Yes.
I wanted to make that as clear. I had said that the British were unhappy initially about supporting Zahedi, based mostly on his. He has a reputation in World War II when he was military governor in Isfahan, and had an involvement with Strassmeyer and the German intelligence network there. You may know Fitzroy McLean's book. He led a British commando team into Isfahan and kidnapped Zahedi. What was it, 43, maybe something or so. So he was not exactly one of their favorites. But anyhow, they came to to support him. I suppose anyone really heard this discussed as to how it came about. Who ultimately made the decision, I expect he was somebody who had, he was a senator, he was a senator. He had good contacts in the military, retired minister particularly, I believe. Of course, there was a lot of resentment among the retired officers because Mossadegh had purged so many of them from the ranks. And there was kind of what seemed to be a solid basis for military operation. I think the main thing was to be assured that the military would not move to support Mossadegh. And of course, he had alienated so many of the military by his actions that, except for his personal guard, the military either a few of them threw in on the side of the Shah, if you like, and the other simply stood aside and let it happen.
Did at that time the United States or the agency have direct contacts with the military, either through the ambassador or otherwise, to gauge their sentiments?
I think I can't say this with a great confidence, but I think there was certainly some contact with the military, and of course the army attaché's office had the job of reporting on the military, on military attitudes and so on. They were not directly involved in the operation. The military and military attaché's office and most of the embassies are usually not aware of things like this that go on. There, you know, no particular reason for them to know. It's not their job. Military attachés from any country, it's their job to keep track of and report on the military activities of the country to which they're assigned. This is not a clandestine operation, mm-hmm. because it's understood by all parties that that's the job of the military.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. At that time in Iran, by this time the CIA had the direct sources of information gathering, or were you relying on the consulates and the embassy staff to send material?
No, of course, the agency had developed their own sources. A lot of them were, a lot of the resources were, a lot of the attention was directed at the Tudor Party. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the major target at that point. Now we're talking about the period of the beginning of the Cold War. We're talking about time when United Nations are fighting the communists in Korea. The Soviet Union has shown its post-war hand in taking over places like Czechoslovakia, in Hungary, in Poland. The attempted the guerrilla war in Greece, which was communist party war against the good government. Soviet threats to Turkey over places like Kars and Ardahan, and Soviet demands for joint control of the straits of the Bosphorus, meaning the Black Sea. So I think it's things like this that led to a concentration on the communist parties in these countries, because they were seen as political weapons that Moscow could use in Iran or in Greece or in Turkey.
And what was your assessment of the Tudeh at that time?
Assessment of the Tudeh at that time, we had pretty good coverage. There were several sources that reported to us from the Tudeh party. And our assessment was that they had the capability, which they indeed did demonstrate, of considerable disruption, political disruption, because they could drag out the crowds. They had infiltrated several government ministries. This is going back to the period when Kavam had put Tudeh party cabinet ministers in. And the first thing they did, let's see, who are they? Eskandari was one of them, I think. I've forgotten the other two right now. But the first thing they did was to move a lot of the Tudeh party members into their ministries. This was not unusual, because this is exactly the technique that the Communist parties followed in other countries when they took a position in the government. Much later, when the French Communist Party for a while had a couple of ministries in the French cabinet, first thing they did was to move their supporters into key positions.
But did you assess?
But overall, our assessment was, while they had the capability of creating a lot of trouble, they had the capability to affect the political positions of non-communist politicians because of what seemed to be their strength. Without a great deal of Soviet support, they were not in a position to actually take control of the government. And at least, say, around 53 after the coup, for example, I remember there was a report that the Central Committee of the Tudeh Party was talking about the possibility of staging a counter-revolution. And our assessment of that was simply that they couldn't do this without massive Soviet support, and there was no indication that the USSR was ready to give them this support.
So you basically saw them more as a creating nuisance, but you didn't assess that they possibly were in a position to take over power in Iraq?
No, I don't think. I don't think we were. We ever came to the conclusion that the party by itself was in a position to take over power.
And then there was no awareness at this time of their infiltration to the armed forces. So these didn't play into your conclusion.
There were a few scattered reports, I think in 1952, maybe early 1953, of Tuta party cells in the armed forces. Mostly it was in the ranks of non-commissioned officers on the Mumhars, which are kind of warrant officers, I guess. But except for sabotage of some Air Force planes, I've forgotten exactly what point that was. There were 8 or 10 of the Air Force, Iranian Air Force planes were sabotaged, destroyed, which was attributed, and as a matter of fact, was done by a Tudor party non-com who then fled the country to Bulgaria. I don't recall immediately, except for a mention that there was a similar organization, the officers, among the officers.
Mark Yasirovsky elsewhere has suggested that the British were doing a lot of staging a lot of the demonstrations in order to force CIA's hand, in other words. Was there any awareness of?
Well, I guess that's kind of a yes and no question. As you probably know, the Iranians often talk about the British Tuta, as opposed to the Soviet Tuta in conjunction. I think part of this is based on kind of, if you like, a folk memory. Or a popular belief that the British and the Russians were always cooperating against Iran. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if there was a Soviet Tudor party, there had to be a British Tudor party. Plus the fact that the British had infiltrated the Tudor party also, as we had.
And you collaborated on information at this time?
Information was exchanged. I mean, there's
even between the analysis sections, not only operations, but also analysis.
Yeah, analytical, not all of it. See, in a liaison relationship, no matter how friendly it is, you're still having liaison with what is, in effect, is another intelligence organization that's working for its own interests. So there's always a bit of wariness as to what information you exchange and what you withhold. So exchange is usually done on a high level with all the material being cleared at several levels inside before it's passed at the highest level. So some analytical reports, I don't know which ones. Occasionally, we'd get a request saying, we want to pass this to the British. Do you see any objections? And then conversely, from time to time, we would see British reports identified as such coming across our desk. This is part of the normal liaison exchange, which dated clear back to the World War II days. Mm-hmm. And actually it was based on an agreement between the United States and the Commonwealth countries as to relatively free exchange of information, mm-hmm. as well as an agreement not to carry on operational activities in each other's countries. For example, CIA would not carry on any clandestine activities in England or in Australia or in New Zealand, and those countries would not carry on clandestine activities in the United States. It was a gentleman's agreement, maybe a little more than a gentleman's agreement. I think it was formalized. But that was the basis for the cooperation.
Well, let's go back to the Shah. What was the impression of him? You mentioned that he was seen as the only source of stability. But what were the impression of him as a person, as a leader at that time? And despite his reluctance, why he became so prominent in Operation Ajax? I mean, once the British accepted Zahedi, why did Slim the Shah come into the picture, although he left the country and abandoned everything?
I think once it is mentioned.